Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection.
Welcome, Ephraim Simchayev, to the Autism Roundtable. You come wearing many different hats in the pediatric community as an occupational therapist, and I know you specialize in many different areas, including executive functioning, reflex integration. Introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background, personal and professional.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast, Leah. So I've been a pediatric occupational therapist for over a decade now. I worked with children of all ages, adolescents, adults, with all types of abilities. My passion was for helping children develop independence and confidence. That's what really drew me to OT. Originally, it's funny, I relate to you. When I first started out, I thought I was going to be a hand therapist and I was going to get my CHT. And then over the years, I got into pediatrics and I love it. I love it. I love it. And it's been a tremendous experience in my life.
Amazing. Amazing. Tell us a little bit about your personal background. I know you have children. Tell us a little bit about that as well.
So funny. I was going to say, I'm a parent of three beautiful children, two girls and a boy. And, you know, what I love about our profession is that when I got into the field, I realized especially when I had kids, I became so much more aware and attuned to them, more patient, because I'm working with kids all day. And when I see my own kids, I found, you know, I could see the real perspective. It really deepens my own empathy for them. And it also deepens my commitment to helping other families. So I really enjoy that. So as an OT and my wife being a social worker, we like always, everything we do at work, we try and practice at home. And it's great. I think it's just fantastic to do the same thing with the kids, whether it's reflex related, whether it's fine motor, just really, I enjoy it.
Incorporating it through the day. That's great.
Exactly.
And I also feel like as a therapist, that's also a parent, I feel like it also helps us understand the struggles of caregivers and parents as well, because we know the struggles. We're there every day. And like, you know, a lot of times the therapists say, could you go home and do 30 minutes of homework? And you know that no one's doing, like, as a parent, 30 minutes of homework is not happening from each discipline.
Right.
So being a realist therapist also happens when you're a parent and a therapist. You're like, okay, I understand if I give 5 to 10 minutes of homework, it might happen, but
right,
30 minutes, not happening.
So, it's very true.
But kudos to you that you're able to incorporate occupational therapy into raising your children as well. Because
absolutely.
We sort of encompass our values, and it's nice to be able to give that back to your biological children as well.
Yeah. You know what? As a parent, I guess we get a front row seat, you know, to the ups and downs of our own children's development. And I think it helps me appreciate every developmental stage. You're seeing the child grow at their own, every child at their own pace. You know, we really try not to compare each child. It's hard. Oh, we saw one child progress there much sooner than the other. But every child has their own strengths, and it's great. It gives me a lot of perspective.
Amazing. What made you choose the field of occupational therapy?
So for me, what I did was, it's a great question. What I did was, when I was a teenager, I walked into a nursing home and I said, I'd like to volunteer. And it was great advice that I got. I think my mentor gave me the advice where he said, go out there, volunteer in many professions and see what you're passionate about, see what you love, and see what connects with your personality. And I checked out speech. I checked out social work. I saw what nurses did, doctors, PAs, and physical therapists. And when I got into occupational therapy, I saw how versatile the field was and how much creativity is involved, how so many different aspects are related to OT. And I felt it really related to my own personality and what I can do, bringing meaningful, purposeful, quality, based activities and enhancing someone's life. And I said, this is a great profession for me. And I chose it.
That's amazing. What are some of the core values of occupational therapy or really future work that you did aside for going to school? But I know you've taken a lot of courses as well. What philosophies do you feel like you incorporate into your work that really are driving forces to helping the children and you feel that really resonate with the children?
So I would say for me, it's building the trust. Personally, my values would be building trust with the children and their families, guiding, ethical decision making in different complex cases, promoting, I would say, physical, emotional, social aspects of health, and I'm trying to think what else. Like, when you say philosophy, do you mean more of like the OT philosophy?
Not the OT philosophy, but like over the years, I know I've learned, there's sort of like a heart that we go with, and there's a certain internal pull that makes us therapists that really helps us and guides our practice, besides for the physical piece and the knowledge that we'll talk about soon, like the executive functioning and the reflexes.
Yes.
But besides for that, like the knowledge, I feel like there are, I follow your status and I get to hear like through your status, all your wonderful philosophy of like living in the moment and supporting each child for who they are. And so tell us a little bit about that journey of the philosophy behind being a therapist and the goals.
I'll tell you like this. When I moved to New Jersey from New York, I said to myself, I'm going to be working with the geriatric population. I'm not going to be working in New York. I'll be focused on New Jersey based. And I got a phone call, I think in 2018, from a gentleman who was from the Heimische world. And he said to me, look, we have a need here in Borough Park to hire a male therapist. And I said, thank you so much, but I'm not looking to work in New York anymore. I'm not traveling. And he said, please, will you just give me an hour of your time? I'll tell you exactly what we do in the facility. It was a private practice. And he said, you would be helping so many teenagers that are struggling with executive functioning, with problem solving. And I wasn't working in that field at all. And I thought I'd be working in the nursing homes and the being a CHT.
Rehab.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going for. And so he came out to New Jersey to meet with me. We walked into a Dunkin' Donuts. We sat in and we discussed exactly what I would be doing. And he really got to my heart, and he said something that was near and dear, in helping, you'd be helping the next generation. You would be helping them perform in their performance skills and their academic performance. You would be helping, enrich their lives. And that really motivated me and empowered me to say, you know what, let me give it a try. Let me try something new. And I said, I'll give it a shot in the summer. That's like, I'm off in the summer anyway, so I'll give it 2 months. And the truth is, I really enjoyed it. And I saw such an amazing, first of all, I learned a lot about myself and my own skills. And I became a much, much, much better of a therapist. And I connected to the community. And I saw how resilient these children were. I saw how much connection. You need to really to connect. And I found that personally, my work in executive functioning, problem solving, emotional regulation, these areas were all areas that allowed these kids to be able to you know, increase their attention span, be able to function in class or in the home. And it was very meaningful.
Wow. That's amazing. That it's very amazing to watch where each one of our journeys take us. Like we bump into different experiences, we get different job offers, and somehow we follow a path and that becomes us. So that's wonderful that you had that experience and you found your place. Tell us, like, break down for us, if you can, what is an executive functioning? Where do we use that in a day? And what's available to help children better themselves in that area?
Sure. So it's a great question. So I can break it down in a few different ways. So executive functioning usually falls under so many different categories. Basically, we'll break it down like this. So you have executive functioning is like the brain's management system. And what it does is it helps set up in the skills that help you plan, organize, manage your time, remember things, prioritize, control your emotions, and different behaviors. So again, these skills are, you need these skills for school, for just general life, for a job, for being married. And usually if a person's having a difficult time with these skills, it's very difficult to function.
So what kind of things are you seeing right now in children that are coming to your office? Maybe like describe us like one or two of your clients that you've encountered recently, and tell us a little bit about how you might address it.
Absolutely. So let's say I have a child who's 13 years old. He's coming in, he's having a difficult time with, he's very impulsive in school. The ability to wait for his turn in a conversation, he's constantly interrupting the teacher. He's having, a difficult time in being more flexible. He's more rigid. A difficult time in, you know, he's clumsy. Let's say he's having I'm thinking of an actual case. He's having a difficult time really with working memory. His ability to hold and manipulate information in his mind for short periods of time, remembering a phone number, remembering, you know, what he has to do for the day. It's challenging dealing with that for a child. It's like the example I think I once heard from you. I think you gave that example once with the gloves. It's like a child.
The body in space. I like to use the oven mitts for the body in space that a child who doesn't know where their body is in space is feels like they're wearing oven mitts, and all day they are looking for where they are in space. They're not sure if they're here, or here. And it could be really frustrating, and it's easy to have breakdowns or a tantrum or interesting behaviors, shutdown behavior, because we're so not feeling comfortable in our space. But as you were actually just describing the child that you were talking about, who's having a hard time with impulse control and maybe social interactions, waiting their turn, I was just thinking, like, that must be really hard on the child, like emotionally as well. Like,
yeah.
We want to actually work on those skills to make them feel like able to interact during their day, but also just to like really think about what that emotionally, how that impacts the child as well.
Right. So for that child, what I would do is initially I would assess them. I would see, you know, before treating them, it's important to assess. So I would look at specific executive functionings that are subcategories that are weak. For example, their working memory, like I mentioned, their planning and organizing, their impulse control, their emotional regulation. So for a child who's having a difficult time with like in their environment, let's say I would adapt, for example, I would adapt their environment in the classroom to reduce any distractions. You know, I provide clear instructions, consistent routines, I think modeling and coaching helps a lot, teaching and practice.
I was getting ready to say, what's modeling and coaching?
So modeling and coaching would be like you teach them. It's basically like you teach and practice skills in real life. So like in real life context, you would talk about, you know, you'd work on perspective taking, work on emotional regulation through mindfulness, deep breathing. So what I do is I do a lot of stop and go exercises.
What's a stop and go exercise?
So for like simple, like kind of like, I'll give you a simple exercise, like red light, green light, 1, 2, 3. That's like a simple kiddie exercise where, you know, they have to control their body, you know, time, go, stop, kind of like freeze. So I would start out very basic. I would grade it up and make activities that would include the cognitive mind, the physical exercises. So I combine the cognitive with the activity. So I'll give you an example. A child who has a difficult time with coordination and difficult time with working memory would incorporate tabletop activities. Let's say we're doing a tabletop activity that requires changing between three colors. And now we have to memorize which color's next. So this red, blue, and green on a specific type of a pattern. Child would, for example, do a distraction activity where the child is, let's say, engaged in a jumping jack, and they have to count backwards from 20 till 1. And counting, let's say 20, and they're doing the jumping jacks, 20, 19, 18. Every 5 counts, they have to remember a specific word that I give them. So now that is, they have to hold information in their mind. They have to remember the colors that they were working with in the pattern they were coloring. And they have to perform a sensory motor activity. So I'm trying to target the coordination. I'm targeting the working memory. And so, again, on top of that, while giving them practical skills in life on how to deal with, you know, and practice impulse control, I combine a cognitive tabletop activity with a physical exercise that encompasses coordination tasks. A coordination activity can be a jumping jack while counting, while recalling a list of 5 words every 4 to 5 jumps. So that means they would need to maintain their coordination when they're jumping. They need to count out loud, and they need to remember the words that were given to them. On top of that, they need to remember and recall the tabletop activity sequence that we were working on previously. So we're combining so many different tasks. We're combining a lot of, you know, problem solving, working memory, we're combining coordination, all in just one activity. So we're challenging different systems.
And why is that important in life? Like, why, you're reminding me of like the Dr. Seuss book, like on a ball, on a hat, on a cat, right? And he's like balancing, and he has all these different things that are on a hook, on a book, right? So why are we challenging a child to do so many different things at once? Like, how does that play into their daily life? What executive functioning skill? Yeah.
So wait, it's a great question, because so the reason why it's important, because it allows us to get things done in life, to manage ourselves, to succeed in everyday life. You know, here's how it plays out. You know, a daily routine, for example, getting dressed. You know, you're packing a bag, you're planning a trip, you're making breakfast. All these things require planning, working memory, sequencing. You know, without executive functioning, even simple tasks can feel very overwhelming and disorganized. So staying focused in class and remembering assignments or doing homework or starting a project on time, or switching between subjects or classrooms, transitioning, could be very difficult. And these skills are that's why these skills are so important. Again, a child who has an executive functioning challenge, again, like I said, would forget, you know, their homework, miss deadlines, constantly feel anxious in life. It could be very difficult. And also it could impact your social relationships. When it comes to especially emotional regulation. So dealing with frustration, dealing with the challenges of life, you know, learning how to think before we act, responding kindly to others. Again, executive functioning would help us with all of these things, social cues, adjusting one's behavior to fit different situations. Even believe it or not, even safety, you know, managing risk, planning ahead, thinking through consequences. These are always playing a huge part in executive functioning.
Yeah. And like children on the autism spectrum, children with ADHD, I think we see a lot of this where they really struggle with what you're explaining, which is really going through life. Executive functioning is going through life. And when you break it down the way you just eloquently did, our brains are doing so much at once during the day. And for someone that is, the brain is not working as quickly, as fast, processing the information at that high speed, it could be very overwhelming. So it's amazing that we've developed skills or like a therapy that could really address it. Have you seen success in addressing executive functioning?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I hear all the time. What I like to do is I like to stay in touch with the parents throughout the years. And let's say I've worked with a child or a teenager, adolescent, and it could be they've tried different types of therapies and maybe not much has worked. And after we work together, let's say 3, 6, 9 months, and I don't hear back from the parents for a little while, you know, people get busy with life. I check back in within a year, and or could be maybe half a year, and I say, hey, how's it going? I actually called someone after 5 years of, we haven't worked together in 5 years, but I found their phone number, and I said, I'll give you a name. Let's say, how is Chaim doing? And the parents said, oh my God, is this a Chaim? I said, yes. You know, we worked on, she goes, don't tell me. The mom would say, I have to tell you, Ephraim, I never thought my child would be like, I understand, like they got better in their academic performance and maybe in learning. She says, but he became the best student. Now, I would never think that a child who struggled in so many different areas is basically what the mom was saying, that he would, you know, reach a level where he's mastered executive functioning, problem solving. He's mastered where difficulties with response inhibition or controlling one's emotions, and he's become the best student, and he's getting married, and he's a full-time learner, and like stories like this gives me a lot of strength to go forward, and I feel like I'm on the right path when I see kids. Now, not everybody benefits from this type of an approach, but I would say 95% of the kids I've worked with that maybe didn't have any other maybe delays or challenges like reflex related or what have you, I would say benefit tremendously. So I've seen a lot of really big success stories.
That's beautiful. And it really, you should feel good about your work being that you really change people's lives for the long term. So that's really amazing work that you do.
Thank you.
And I love that you touch back with your clients as well. And as parents, I always, you know, encourage parents to give us the feedback, because then it helps us to continue what we do and see, you know, what benefits each child. So,
right.
That is nice that you have that relationship. How long would you say it takes for each child to remediate when we're working with an executive functioning child?
So it's a great question. I get this question all the time. You know, how long until I see results? Will it take a few months? Will it take a few weeks? Can it take longer? You know, every child is so different. Every child develops differently, processes differently. And I think it really depends on each child. It depends on the kind of connection you build with the child, the parents, perhaps even, you know, the consistency of the therapy. I find that if someone is really out there to and he's inspired or she's inspired to make progress in their therapy, and they want to work and they're excited, that it could be a little bit faster, and sometimes it could be a little bit slower and longer. It really depends on each case. Each need, each case is very different.
I would have to agree with you. I find that each child remediates so differently, and especially executive functioning or processing that comes along with a diagnosis. A lot of times it could take a nice amount of time to get there. And I always tell parents to just hang tight, because you came for a purpose, and stay and hang in there and stay with us so that we could meet that purpose. So it's definitely a challenge. And I know it's challenging for parents also to like wait the time. We want to wave a magic wand and have everything fixed. But really, it's part of like building the neural networks for the children when they're doing this executive functioning work. They're building networks in their brain that allows them then to be able to do 1, 2, 3 different things at a time. It takes time to develop that.
Yeah, and you know, we're working with the prefrontal cortex, which is the CEO of the brain. And basically, like when we're, I always think of it this way. Whenever I'm working with executive functioning, I always think of it as I'm working with the forehead and the prefrontal cortex, the decision making, the impulse control, the work. This is where all of that happens. And, you know, I'm also working with the basal ganglia, which, you know, it was working on the motivation and the habit formation and the task initiation. So, and like when you have all of these areas of the brain that, personally, myself, I really get intrigued with, and I love looking at the limbic system, which is the emotional regulation, which is, you know, the stress responses, the cerebellum, which I find is the coordination, it's the motor control, the timing and sequencing and that's how I like to describe it to parents when working with all of these areas. I'm targeting different parts of the brain. And I love explaining it this way, and I like explaining it very simply, how each part of the brain is influenced and how each part of the brain is, you know, we know today with all the research, it's all neuroplastic. It's constantly changing, right?
It's amazing. And, you know, another piece of frame that I find very amazing, and being that you're talking about the brain, I'm sure you'll have insight on it, is I love to watch how different children have different pieces of the mind, of the brain, and one might be like really, really intelligent, really, really smart in one area, and then let's say very low functioning in emotional regulation, or really, really great at language, and then quite poor at, you know, decision making. So it is very cool to see how we have strengths in different areas and weaknesses in different areas. And like, just because we struggle in one area doesn't label us as smart or dumb, or doesn't label us as incapable. Like, we can almost highlight the strong parts of our brain and rely on them heavily to help us get through the parts of our brain that might be a little bit more challenged.
Absolutely. I have to agree with you on that. Absolutely. Yes.
It's very fascinating to watch how every child's that, you know, different and what's highlighted there. Okay, so you were talking about the limbic system for a minute, and I got very, my limbic system lit up right there. Tell us a little bit about the emotional regulation work that you do as an occupational therapist.
So that's a great question. So emotional regulation really, you know, why is the limbic system so important in occupational therapy? Again, emotional, I'll just break it down for parents or for different clients that want to know more about it. It's really the limbic system ties to the reward and the pleasure circuits and the different dopamine pathways, which really impact how motivated someone would feel to do an activity, to complete an activity, and to really initiate. So we can really, as therapists, as occupational therapists, we can help really clients really of all ages find meaning and enjoyment and tasks to increase the motivation. And what I like to do is I like to, in the assessment, I like to really figure out what's meaningful to this person, the child. I speak to the parents a lot of communication with the parents on my end, a lot of parent education. I learn a lot about the child through speaking to the parent in the assessment. And it really depends. So the question was, how do you deal with the emotional regulation?
Yeah. Or like, I was actually also thinking, like, let's say when you're evaluating a child that has very high energy levels, what's going on with their limbic system? Why can't they attend? Why can't they focus? Why do they keep on moving from one activity to another?
So the way that I would put it is the limbic system really is. So the key structures of the limbic system group, they're all interconnected with the brain. So really it's the limbic system is the emotional center of the brain. And like I said earlier, it helps you feel, react, and remember. So it could be as I went on throughout the years of learning different modalities, I've realized, like, you know, a child could have gone through something difficult, maybe a traumatic experience, a traumatic birth. That could be one part of it. Have you seen that personally?
Yes, I've seen a lot of, I've actually seen clients a lot of times. I always say, like, the parents are like, I don't know what the traumatic event was. And I'll say, it could have been in utero. It's not necessarily like a blame thing or anything like that. It's more
right,
of like,
exactly.
What were the child's experiences pre-birth, through birth, after birth, that contributed to this child's makeup, experiences, and feelings?
So exactly. So it could be God forbid, a brain injury or, concussion or illnesses affecting that can disrupt the brain or the neural pathways, which impact the limbic system. It could be a chemical imbalance where things like the serotonin or dopamine or neuroepinephrine can influence, you know, one's mood or emotional regulation. So it could be a genetic factor. It really depends. Every child is different. And I always go back to the prefrontal cortex because I feel that the prefrontal cortex really helps. It really helps regulate the limbic system. It's like think of it this way. It's like driving a car, you know, and the brake pedal is really the emotional response where you're able to control. So the prefrontal cortex, which is underdeveloped, would not, you know, well respond or connect. So
it's kind of stuck.
Exactly. It's kind of stuck. Yeah.
That's doesn't want to let you hit on those brakes. So what kind of treatment might you do for individuals that are having emotional regulation issues? So we discussed for a couple minutes there why we might have emotional regulation issues. It might be the way our brain is made up. It might be some in utero things that happen. It might be the birth. It might be post-birth trauma, whatever it might be that an individual is having a really hard time regulating. What kind of successful treatment have you conducted where you've seen some really nice improvement with regulation?
So reflex integration, I found to be very, very, very useful in my line of work. For those that don't know, reflex integration. So what it means is, what are reflexes? A reflex is something that is developed in the brainstem right before your person is born. And usually, these things integrate, these reflexes integrate between 4 to 8 months. And So again, a reflex would help a baby with positioning, with breathing, with feeding, with going to the bathroom. So all of these reflexes, if they remain in the body, they may interfere with neurological, I guess, responses.
Development.
Yeah. So which really also can cause a lot of learning disabilities or challenges, social, behavioral. So I've incorporated a lot of reflex integration into my line of work. And I find reflexes are really a lot, they're not the end all and be all, but I do find a lot of the things that I've seen, like I mentioned earlier, you know, trauma can induce these reflexes again.
The forefront, and then sort of when you do treatment and you integrate these reflexes, you see that children are able to then regulate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I integrate these reflexes, I definitely see more voluntary control. I see a lot more regulation. I'll give you an example, like a moral reflex. What is a moral reflex? A moral reflex is a startle response. You ever see a baby hear a loud thump or a loud sound, and that noise, you see like the baby kind of like gets startled. And if it's retained, a child may overreact or to different sounds or sudden changes, and they may show signs of anxiety. So I find that a child or even an adolescent or even adults sometimes, if they have this moral reflex that's not integrated, there's a lot more anxiety or emotional reactivity or distractibility. Now, I'm not sure if you can relate or you can agree with that, but I would love to hear what your thoughts on the moral reflex are.
Oh, I love integrating the moral reflex. It's one of my favorites. I usually start there because exactly that. We're seeing so much anxiety in today's day and age, and children are fearful. And if we're in fight or flight, then we can't regulate. So it definitely integrating the moral reflex is like so important. And I think it also helps so much with our self-regulation, emotional regulation. So yes, definitely a huge piece of me, of how I practice occupational therapy as well. Aside for the MARO, I love to also address like the ATNR, which I know is also related to executive functioning. So tell me a little bit about that. Do you work with the ATNR or the STNR, and how does that affect?
Yeah, the ATNR. So the asymmetrical tonic neck reflex, and usually, so how it presents is it's a reflex that's basically it's triggered when the head turns to one side, and usually it's causing the opposite. It's causing the arm and the leg on that same side to extend and to go out. But if it's retained in a child, I mean, you see it all the time. If it's retained in a child or even a teenager sometimes, you might have trouble with crossing the midline you could see things like poor handwriting or difficulty in tracking different lines of text. So I've seen a lot of children with coordination difficulties on both sides of the body, really, during activities. So, and the STNR, which I find personally, I've seen babies that if their STNR, it's the symmetrical tonic neck reflex, which I think impacts a lot of the crawling. It really helps with the crawling and the positioning of a baby. And usually if a baby is struggling in integrating that reflex, or even a toddler, they have a difficult time with slouching or fidgeting, or they have a hard time with focus, and they have a need to constantly move. Yeah.
And I get that question all the time. Is it important for my baby to crawl? And I always say like, yes, it is so important. And we want to make sure that all children really go through all stages of development. So if you're a mom listening and you have a little one and you're like, oh, should I just kick therapy down the road? I think so. It's really, really important for kids to really go through the developmental patterns, even if they're not on time. But crawling is super duper important. Ephraim, would you like to speak to why it's so important?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Well, so funny. One of my children, I'm not going to say who, did not crawl.
Oh, no.
And until she was a little bit older and we were really concerned, and I was like doing everything possible, and for some reason she wasn't crawling. So here's why I think crawling is so important. Crawling requires, you know, the use of both sides of the body. And I think it helps with coordination. It helps strengthen the connection between both the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain. So, I mean, thank God she's so advanced now. So again, I guess it goes to show that every child develops a little bit differently.
And in therapy, that's what we do. Like when someone comes in and says, oh, my daughter didn't crawl. And then we also see that they're having a hard time with handwriting and with crossing midline, jumping jacks, doing the monkey bars. So in the therapy room, even at age 7, 8, 9, so if your child didn't crawl, there is ways to fix it. We'll take them through that crawling pattern so that they can then develop it, which it sounds like what you did with your daughter. You got her to do it.
And eventually she got it. Eventually she got it. I think the mistake we did with her was we didn't do enough tummy time because she was one of our first, and we were always holding her, and it was during COVID. And so I think we were super attached, and we did everything. You know, we were at her beck and call, and we were, you know, first-time parents. And so we learned. We definitely learned. But she crawled later on.
Isn't that amazing how we get a manual to become a therapist? We get a manual how to take care of our cars. But we don't get a manual how to be a parent. So, you know, even it's actually comforting to parents, I think, to hear that sometimes even with our academic backgrounds, we made mistakes, and that's okay. And there's ways to continue and help our children later in life as well. So, yeah, continue. Sorry about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I would say it also strengthens your core muscles. You know, crawling would build your shoulder stability, your core stability, your hip strength, basically all essential things that you need for sitting upright or even writing or different tasks that you would be involved in. I would say that it develops your eye-hand coordination, your visual skills. I mean, it's so important. And again, crawling is all related to integrate. The crawling is integrated with ATNR and the STNR. Both of these reflexes would need to be integrated. And this means, like, you know, you would have fewer coordination difficulties, you know, better balance, you know, less fidgeting. I would say even proprioceptive input and vestibular input. So proprioceptive input would mean the awareness of where one's body is in space. And the vestibular input would be balance and movement. So many areas that just crawling would cover.
Yeah, because like you were saying with the vestibular in the crawling, like when a child, it goes on a swing. So in our inner ear, we have these particles. And when they're activated, our vestibular system is activated. When a child goes through that crawling pattern, so their body is constantly not in an upright position, but in the crawling position, and their head's in a different location than when we're in the upright position. So they're getting tons of vestibular input when they're crawling. A child that skips that stage of being in that vestibular position, or like you were saying, if a child's not getting tummy time and they're not horizontal, they're missing out on those vestibular moments. And then maybe later in life, we're going to see that they're very hyperactive because they're trying to make up for those moments. They're always seeking vestibular input in their environment because their sensory system was never satiated. So,
well said. That exactly what you said there. Their sensory system was never satiated. That's it. Yeah.
And then as OTs and as parents carrying over the OT protocols, we're always trying to give them different sensory experiences that will make up for that time lost. or those, I like to say, neural networks that were never built, because we need to build them so that then the system could be satiated and be regulated and feel happy in its place.
Absolutely agree with you. Yes.
Now, let me ask you a little bit about the Gallant. Do you ever touch on the Gallant reflex?
The Gallant reflex. Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So how do you see an unintegrated Gallant looking, and why would you want to integrate it?
So the Gallant reflex and the way it works is basically it's present at when a baby is born, and it helps babies develop the flexibility and coordination they need, I would say, for crawling and walking later on. So when you so basically the way you would look at the Gallant is like this. You would have the baby lying on their tummy, and you would stroke along the side of a baby's lower back, like near the spine, with your finger, or I use a pencil, really depends, something that's maybe soft. And they would bend or arch toward that side. And that's how you test for it. And you do the same thing on the opposite side. So this reflex would help. I actually see a lot of children that have a Gallant reflex that's not integrated have difficulties with bedwetting.
Yes.
I don't know if you see that, or difficulties with attention and focus, coordination, posture and sitting. So again, it's so important to integrate this reflex.
Yeah, that's one of the main things that I go to. I know bedwetting on older children is really such an issue, and it's so hard to deal with. And I do find that when we integrate the Gallant, not 100% of the time, but a lot of the times, we see an improvement in bladder control.
Yes.
So that is a very interesting thing that I was happy when I learned about it, because it's a part of treatment that we want to help parents when they're having difficulty with bedwetting or, you know, incontinence. But we want to, you know, it's always nice to have that extra thing to pull out of your bag. And also a lot of our children that are presenting as ADHD are very sensory seeking. A lot that fidgety movement, where imagine, like you said, when you run your finger over their spine or the back of a spoon or a pen and they move, right? Imagine if you were being distracted by your lower back all the time and fidgeting, right? That might be really difficult. So if you integrate it, we do see some really nice things with the Gallant.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so Ephraim, you have given us so much amazing information today. I loved having this conversation with you. If you could give a message to caregivers of individuals with developmental disabilities or just overall developmental delays, parents, what would that message be?
Wow. So I would say a few things. I would say stay consistent, observe the changes. You know, small improvements, you have to always watch for small improvements, always celebrate, focus on the strengths, positivity, you know, connect before you correct.
I love that. Connect before you correct. Okay, I'm going to use that one, because that is really so lovely.
It's so powerful and it's so true. And you have to provide a calm environment, you know, to help that child feel safe. Feeling safe and regulated with you, and, you know, team working with the parents, because really the therapy that we do, a lot of times we see the child could be for an hour or two a week, or maybe less, maybe a little more, but then they go home and then they see their parents 6-7 days a week. I feel working with the parents, that education for the parents is very important. That's why I say team working, sharing observations, keeping routines, and consistency is really the key. And again, these, you know, staying with consistency, I would say staying with the exercises, trying them, working on crawling, rocking, core exercises. Again, we want to help build the foundations and make them a part of a daily routine.
Amazing. Thank you, Ephraim. I love all your positivity. I love your outlook on therapy. Thank you so much for sharing with us all this amazing information on how our brains work, how executive functioning works, how reflex integration is incorporated. Really appreciate all your insight.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Leif, to have me on this podcast. It's really fantastic.